Hi, I'm Dahlia Lithwick, legal correspondent, author, and host of Slate's Amicus Podcast, a show about the rule of law, the law, and the Supreme Court justices who interpret it for the rest of us. I've been watching the High Court for over two decades, and I bring all that experience and knowledge to examining the U.S. justice system and democracy. Each episode, I am joined by guests with deep knowledge of the law and policy who help me and you navigate our constitutional landscape. Slate's Amicus Podcast. Subscribe now wherever you listen.
Hello, it's Jen Taub. Welcome back to Booked Up, a podcast that features you, me, and our favorite authors. We release a new episode every Sunday morning. Today, we are all about Barbie, the movie, the doll, the legend. Too much hype? No, not enough. This month's new blockbuster film, directed by Greta Gerwig, starring Margot Robbie and Ryan Gosling, has more than just the best one-liners. She's everything, he's just Ken. It also provides theater audiences the opportunity to share howls of laughter, delighted about the humorous send-up of the patriarchy, and also to sob openly about what our lives could have been if more girls' imaginations were able to flourish as grown women instead of us becoming accessories enlisted in service of the ambitions of powerful men. Because Booked Up always is about books, our Barbie book club members today include M.G. Lord, author of Forever Barbie, the unauthorized biography of a real doll, originally published in 1994. Plus, M.G. has a fresh three-part podcast series out now called L.A. Made, The Barbie Tapes, which features audio from her one-on-one interviews with Barbie inventor and Mattel founder Ruth Handler, among others. We'll get into that. MG has written for numerous publications, including the New York Times, Book Review, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times. She's an associate professor of the practice of English at USC. Also joining the Barbie Book Club today is George Hahn. Cuter than a Ken doll, more awesome than Alan, there is no better example of how to live an urban bon vivant life while on a bicycle than George Hahn. George, in his own witty words, is a self-made thousandaire playboy who wears tailored clothing, drinks coffee, talks on podcasts, and occasionally writes and does television. You may know George from his screen roles in Sex and the City, Law and Order, Criminal Intent, and Miramax's Kate and Leopold. He also has a new podcast called Han Solo and a website, georgehahn.com, and that's spelled H-A-H-N. That features menswear, grooming, lifestyle essays, and advice. Okay, let's dive in.
For you, George, I think earring magic Ken.
I had an earring magic Ken in the 90s with his purple vinyl pleatherish vest and his cock ring. Oh, I can't say that on the... Oh, my God. I've never said that word out loud.
You can say cock ring? Oh,
I know,
well.
But I'm not a gay man.
Never said it out loud? Welcome to the party.
It feels liberating.
I actually managed to say it on NPR by mentioning that Dan Savage described it as another kind of ring, and then they put in the link to
well,
Dan.
When one talks to Dan Savage, one must talk to Dan Savage. Come on.
I couldn't believe when this came out in the 90s. My roommate at the time, I was living in New York. I must have been working at a law firm, and my roommate, Ted Mills, hey, Ted, I think that's when we bought this.
Oh,
and
good.
His earrings, right? One says Ken and one says Barbie.
Well, but he also has one little earring on the left side.
Right.
And the unmentionable, what do they call it? They call it Mattel calls it something like a ring pendant around his neck.
Gayest. That is like.
This is like,
God.
You could take him right to Limelight and he would be fine.
Also very early 90s. When I first saw the images, long before the movie was released, about this time last summer when Gosling and Robbie.
Ryan Gosling.
Yes.
And, yeah.
We're on
Margot Robbie. Yeah.
Yes. We're on the, were on the boardwalk in Venice in their roller skates. I was so excited to realize that the production design would be referencing all these classic 1990s dolls.
So I want to, since we just kind of did this in the middle of things, which is, you know, how life is, I just want to back up a little bit and find out where you both are now. MG, I see that there's a cat. You have a cat, and you have Barbies. But are you in California or the East Coast?
No, I live in LA. I'm an associate professor of the practice of English at USC.
I love how they have to say that so the other professors who have PhDs, you know, it's like a little scarlet letter. You're of practice. They don't practice. They're steeped in Chaucer and what have you. But you practice. Is that the idea?
I think it's a badge of honor. Actually,
yes.
It
okay.
means that, you know, from time to time I can actually sell a book to a trade publisher. And, I think it means that I don't have to make really cumbersome syllabi. I mean, I do have to teach one GE class, but. But otherwise, they're mostly workshops, so people can, you know, I give them.
What do you mean, GE, general ed? So what?
Yeah,
do you,
right.
What do you teach? Like, I bet there are long lines to get into your classes.
Well, I hope there will be now, because USC is really undermining whatever credential I might have had by presenting me as the Barbie expert on their website.
Are you kidding? I would love. No. That's a badge of honor.
You've got dolls. Like, who's behind you in the box?
Who else do I? That one is wild. She's new. I just got her at World of Barbie. I mean, I have my precious Midge here too. Midge is.
You have a Midge?
I have the Midge from childhood that my mother gave me, trying to head off the Barbie thing at the pass because she was so aghast. Midge is, you know,
the pregnant one, right?
The one. No, well, she wasn't pregnant in 1963. I can assure you of that. She was just a little less attractive than Barbie, and my mother was less unsettled by her. But
she looks like Alfred Hitchcock's daughter who stars in all those films. What is her name? You know what I mean?
I know exactly who you mean.
She's like in North by Northwest?
She's in Strangers on a Train.
Oh, Strangers on a Train.
But I learned the Agnes Gooch move from my Midge doll, you know, where you take off your glasses and suddenly, well, it doesn't really work for Midge, but suddenly, you know, you
become
this sexy
person. Put the glasses back on, because you kind of look like Midge when you both are wearing glasses.
What a terrible thought. That was so upsetting. I dropped the glasses.
Oh, no, she's adorable. Are you kidding? I consider that a compliment. It's the glasses. I mean, you're Barbie except for the glasses. Okay, so George, where are you?
I am in my Mojo Dojo Casa house in New York City.
I love that. You know, I saw Leah Lipman. I think, you know, she's a Supreme Court scholar. I guess we call them constitutional law scholars. And I think she put something up on the website formerly known as Twitter, petition to rename this building the Mojo Dojo Casa House. And there was a photo of the U.S. Supreme Court. Did you see that?
That's great.
That's really funny.
So good. Okay, wait. So let's just like start. Do you want to start? It's really up to you. Do we want to start with everything you know about Barbie and your meetings with Ruth Handler? Do we got to talk about the movie? Or how do we do this? George, you decide. What should MG do first?
But you don't want a ponderous lecture from MG, so avoiding that would be a good idea.
I'd be so curious about your history with Barbie.
Yeah. We want to know how you got, like, you wrote this book, published a book in 1994 called Forever Barbie.
Mm-hmm.
And for that book, you did these interviews with Ruth Handler, her husband, and so many other people who were there on the ground floor. And what's amazing is you right now have a podcast out called LA Made, the Barbie Tapes, and people can listen to that and hear that audio. But can you, George and I want to know how you got into this besides the fact that your mother wouldn't actually let you have a Barbie, nor would mine, by the way.
Oh, well, I wound up with the whole collection, and I guess I shouldn't be so uncomfortable in an academic setting because my mother It's interesting. My mother died when I was a little girl, about the time I played with Barbie.
Oh, that's
great. I found in the Barbie cases kind of a museum of her values. She was always very big on education. And I don't know what this says about her marriage, but she refused to let my Barbie Midge and two Kens, I always preferred them and their clothes to, you know, to the one. Well, except for Midge, this was such a... This is a sensible, fantastic, attractive outfit. I'm holding up Midge in Busy Gal, the one that came with the fashion sketches. But it was a museum of her value. She never let me have a wedding dress. But every single one of those dolls had a little graduation robe and a mortarboard, you know, issued by Mattel. It was very clear that if I was going to have these, if I was going to have these things in the house as a child, she was going to direct me to fantasize the kind of life that she thought was appropriate.
Wait,
insofar as you could. The graduation robes, by the way, were not pink.
But do they come with? I'm a bit confused because
it was a real set, a graduation set with a cap and a gown and a little.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't know.
Was it a more black mortarboard and black gown, or were the other,
yeah.
Was it pink?
Oh. No, it wasn't pink. I mean, this was in the middle 1960s. This would have been, you know, when I was a little girl, like 1965 or 6 or something. And the Ken's was cut differently because Ken could wear a little necktie under his, and the girls had little collars, kind of RBG-esque.
MG, as a refresher, when was Barbie introduced to the market?
Oh, Barbie, and I do kind of wish I had my original in my hand. Barbie wobbled in on those stiletto heels in 1959.
Okay.
And she was based on this creature we were looking at earlier. She was based on the Build Lily doll, this doll was based on a single panel cartoon in the Bild-Zeitung, kind of a downscale German newspaper published in Hamburg. And anyway, the personality of this doll was very different from the all-American personality of Barbie. She basically...
I'm sorry to cut you off, but like, can we just back up to...
Am I rambling?
You're not rambling. I want you to ramble, but I know so much more than maybe the listeners. So first of all, Bild is spelled B-I-L-D, correct?
Yeah, like it means picture in German. It's the picture newspaper and Zeitung.
And Ruth Handler, this is during the World War II, Ruth Handler's husband goes off to war.
Right.
And she starts up a toy company, right?
Right.
Called Mattel, named after a guy, Matthew, and her husband, Elliot.
Harold Mattson.
Mattson, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and Elliot, right.
So when you say that Barbie debuts in 1959, how did this, and you showed us this this German doll who looks like a prostitute, which you'll explain. Not that there's anything wrong with sex work.
I was going to say that I'm being very, in the early 1990s, if you listen to L.A. Made the Barbie tapes, you hear Jack Ryan, who, among other things, was a husband of Zsa Zsa Gabor, and a Yale-educated engineer who was involved with some of the... Ruth Handler invented the thing, but he was involved with some of the production from an engineering standpoint when the doll was made in Japan. But you hear him describe her in ways that are not as delicate, shall we say, as German sex worker.
And so we have Ruth Handler, who's... starting a toy company, and like their first big toy is like a gun.
The burp gun. Well, the big thing with the burp gun, Jen, is it isn't necessarily the product itself, though I guess lots of little boys in 1955 were pretending to, slaughter wild animals with this object. But it was how that was marketed. Other toy companies had experimented with advertising to kids on television, but Mattel took a big risk in 1955. It gambled its entire net worth, which was about $500,000, to buy advertising on the Mickey Mouse Club show. It was brilliant because it allowed the toy maker to advertise directly to children via television and just circumvent the parents. And it changed the whole toy industry from being like a mom and pop thing to being year round and big business. And of course, the advertising directly to children would figure in the launch, in the unexpectedly wobbly launch of Barbie.
So, and that's how I want to lay that groundwork, because you have a company, you had a successful, innovative way to market directly to kids. And then comes this game-changing product, which is going to be the Barbie doll. But can you remind us of how Ruth Handler, how she decided to make a fashion doll for American girls when we had not had something like that? I mean, the movie kind of touches on that in a very funny way at the beginning, but can you actually spell that out for us?
Well, that is a big thing. I mean, in the past, most dolls, you know, there were little fashion, there were replicas of historical figures and so forth that were dolls. But in the mid-20th century, girls really just had the option of playing with baby dolls. You know, it was like the burdensome pet that your parent has to take care of. I mentioned this largely because my cat was shedding all over my lap a few minutes ago. I mean, all that, you know, girls were just taught to nurture.
So the doll was, what the baby doll was, is supposedly for girls, was let's train you on how to be a mom, as opposed to...
Exactly. I'm going to cut you off, Jen.
Go,
let's
you cut me off.
Imagine an exciting future by projecting yourselves onto this, you know, German sex worker who is really the all-American girl. I never really had aspirations in that way, but...
Listen, you shoot an arrow and it goes real high. Hooray for you.
Well, you know, my dream was a little modified, but under these stylish, austere clothes and behind those glasses, Midge, too, had that body.
Yeah. She looked like Patricia Hitchcock.
That is so funny. So we have Ruth. Ruth's got this company set up, Mattel, after that guy, Madsen, you said, and her husband, Elliot. And they go, she happens to be on vacation because they have money with the kids, her daughter, Barbara, and whoever the son is. I'm guessing his name is something like Ben or Ken or something.
Her name is, I mean, it's more perverse. I mean, her daughter is Barbie and her son is Ken.
Yeah. Okay.
Which makes for a very unusual idea around coupledom, but
yeah,
that's for another psychoanalytic podcast.
Yes. And so they go off to Europe and Ruth sees this doll in a window, right? Sitting on a swing or something.
Well, it was probably a doll sitting like in a tobacco shop or something, because it was, you know, it was a gag gift for men based on this lurid character in the Bildzeitung. I translated all the ads in about 3 or 4 years of the single panel comic strip. So I can say with authority that Lily, you know, took money from Jowly Fat Cats for sexual favors over the course of several years in that strip.
So she's Elizabeth Taylor and Butterfield 8, in other words.
Well, yeah, I mean, she's more like actually.
Holly Golightly. Let's be real.
Well, I would say Maria Brown in Fassbinder's The Marriage of Maria Brown, you know, a German woman who had starved and suffered during the war. But as long as there were men with checkbooks, she would never starve and suffer again.
Well, good for her. Okay, so she sees this doll.
Again, I have to emphasize, it was not in a toy store. Not where the advertising has like this doll in this outfit with another holding hands with another Lily doll in an even scanty outfit. And the caption is, whether more or less naked, Lily is always discreet. I mean, this really, it really was a stroke of inspiration to position this as a three-dimensional paper doll onto which young American girls could project their adult identity.
So I'm going to fast forward. She brings a doll home, like two of them, one for herself, one for her daughter. And what I think is so funny is that she decides she wants to turn this in. She wants an exact copy. She wants to turn it into a doll for American girls. And that's how she brings this other guy in that you mentioned to help make prototypes in Japan so they could get it right.
But there were other, in fairness, there were other engineers and other people working for Mattel. But Jack Ryan is kind of a colorful figure. So the default is to talk about him.
But I love in your podcast the tapes with him because it turns out, I guess I just have to say these things. Every single person who's listening to this has taken the shirt off of a Barbie and seen what's underneath, which is sort of mounds with no nipples, right? Can we just... Right? Is that correct? But the doll, Lily, had nipples.
No,
is that
actually,
right?
Lily did not have nipples. The prototypes were made in Japan, and the Japanese manufacturer embellished the doll with unwelcome details that Jack Ryan had to remove.
He was sanding down the nipples, which I think is just such a crazy thing.
They kept
sending it back. I know, George, right? Do you have questions
with the little file,
so
you know, the little Swiss file. He had a reputation as a notorious playboy, but Jack is also
ahead. People can listen to all these details, but since we're talking about the anatomy of these dolls, I want to ask about Ken and his anatomy. And George, maybe you should take over from here because maybe you have more questions.
Well, my knowledge of, Ken came from my sister's dolls. I mean, my sister is 3 years older than I. She had Barbies. And I had, when I was a kid, G.I. Joe dolls and the $6 Million Man,
Steve Austin
doll. And those dolls were all 12 inches. They were all the same proportions at the time. So my Steve Austin G.I. Joe universe had a lot of crossover with my sister's Barbie Dreamhouse universe. And there was a lot of, yeah. So not just Ken, but Steve Austin, like that was the mode, like just cut off any sexual identity on them anatomically. They all look the same from the neck down and unclothed. I don't know. If I were the head of a toy company, marketing something to kids.
Yeah.
It is, I guess, confusing, but I'm, you know, as an adult who actually did play with these toys, looking back, I can't say that it screwed me up.
I think it makes sense. I think it'd be kind of creepy to actually have genitals on the dolls, right?
I mean, there was a joke doll for gay men marketed. I think it started in the 90s called the Billy doll. And if you unclothed a Billy doll, he was, let's just say, had a lot of talent below the waist. There was a lot, very gifted. But that was a joke. That's different.
Happened in the boardroom, you know.
Yeah, well, the design. I mean,
but if I were part of the board, I would have made the same call. If we're talking
didn't make that call. Actually,
this is what's funny.
I mean,
that's
what's so funny in the tape. And in fact, it was Mrs. Handler and Charlotte Johnson, Barbie's first dress designer, who was. I actually didn't interview her. A colleague of mine, Ella King Torrey, began doing some of this work, first Collar of the House project at Yale in the 70s. But Mrs. Handler and Charlotte argued in favor of some kind of bump. So the second episode of our podcast we call the Battle of the Bulge because the male executives were aghast. And the sculpture did, as Charlotte put it, one, you know, that looked like Barbie. One that had, you know, the bump, and the other, as Charlotte put it, that really was. So you're in the Mattel boardroom and you've got these naked dolls. And the men finally caved on the bump thing, but one of them, it's like only if they paint jockey shorts over it. And Charlotte said, you know what every little girl in America is gonna do? They're going to scrape that paint off to see what's under it. And, you know, the Ken has sort of my first Ken somewhere, and he did not have painted on jockey shorts, but he was different. You know, the compromise was a recognition that there was some difference, just not explicitness. And it's also interesting, I mean, or I find it interesting because I'm fascinated by these plastic objects, that G.I. Joe, a Hasbro product, had no differentiation from Barbie in that region. Whereas Ken, you know, at least, you know, there was some recognition that he might have, while significantly deficient, he was different in the crotch. I like to position him as a eunuch priest in a goddess cult.
Oh, my goodness. But keep in mind, MG, that G.I. Joe has a gun, which has always been a stand-in.
But Ken...
Yeah, G.I. Joe's got a gun. He's a real man.
Ken had an enormous rifle. After this battle around Ken's genital abridgment, his subsequent outfits all had these outrageous phallic props, which I could remove from the little Ken. A gun for the Ken hunting outfit, an atypically large baseball bat, you know, a doctor outfit with a pendulous stethoscope, and the absolute, wait for it, the absolute most humiliating thing for this poor male doll was an outfit called Cheerful Chef, which, unlike Barbie's backyard barbecue outfit, came with a long fork skewering a pink plastic weenie. Barbie never had fork or weenie, and that's not enough for the mockery. He's this guy holding this thing with this weenie on it, and his apron says, poignantly, come and get it.
Now, this is when you take Barbie out of the equation and bring in G.I. Joe with the kung fu grip and really put that grip to use. Am I right?
Oh, see. That's where fun to play with you.
That's where the universes cross over.
So I feel really funny. I feel like I've regressed because the first thing, you know, we talk about kids doing is undressing these toys. And this is what I did at the beginning of the conversation because I am not, I don't know, I'm regressing because of Barbie. So let's talk a bit about the one thing before the movies, which is the movie itself, which is, I found it really interesting, the choices that Ruth made about who Barbie was. And in some ways, Barbie could be anybody, right? You could project onto her anything except one thing, which was she was not going to be cleaning house. Or having a baby. So this was like, Barbie was Mary Tyler Moore. She was going to be a single woman with her own money, her own career, and a sort of accessory boyfriend.
It was also the message of Helen Gurley Brown's 1962 book, Sex and the Single Girl, which, despite all that breathy prose, was an anti-marriage manifesto and an argument for women's financial and sexual autonomy.
And so this brings me to, I mean, the movie, I feel like there's so many layers to the movie where it gets into this, and it even gets in deeper to the fact that we haven't talked about Barbie being, you know, blonde, thin, blue eyes, you know, this, or at least the stereotypical Barbie, not all of them were that, and how that is held out as in a sort of white supremacist culture, how that's held out in a certain way. And yet conservatives have never liked Barbie.
Kind of like the Aryan dream.
Except she is too centered. Her life centers her own narrative, whereas she's not in service of the accessory of, right? Is that what it is, MG? Because I'm shocked that all the conservatives, not just now, hate the movie, but have never really celebrated Barbie at all, or any of her various forms?
Well, it was the Barbie world was a very female-centric universe. Ken was an accessory. You know, it's almost, I've been thinking about that recently, that when little girls play with the doll, I still can't get over the Kung Fu grip thing. I'm getting my head around that. It's going to take a while.
G.I. Joe had a Kung Fu grip. Yeah. It was a selling point for the toy.
Well, I bet, you know, I'm just thinking in the movie when Ken subverts Barbie land, I bet they're all learning those Kung Fu grips. I'm going to watch the movie again with that in mind. But it was a totally female-centric universe. The Barbies did everything. Well, I interviewed a lot of kids in the 1990s, and of course they've now grown up to be successful and so forth. But in particular, two little girls here in Los Angeles with screenwriter parents, they had, I don't know, a couple dozen, maybe more Barbies and two overextended Kens. This is really Los Angeles. And one Ken, as you can imagine, you know, was exploited for sex with all the Barbies. But the other one was the full-time valet parking attendant who brought the cars around for the Barbies. It was, you know, the male dolls were peripheral to this universe. And then, of course, you go through puberty, you put your Barbies away, and you put your Barbies away and you discover patriarchy and, you know, and the oppression and demands that get visited on you as a woman. And that was grim. Sorry.
No, but the movie deals. I mean, what I find so okay. So I just this is a slight pivot, which maybe will get us into the movie. But why is Barbie and Ken and the whole world so popular in queer culture?
Because she's like a drag queen. We like gay men have always been attracted to, or like Barbie is. Like Marilyn Monroe. Barbie is, you know, going back further, Betty Grable, Marlena Dietrich. That's when I said Aryan dream. I meant like physically Barbie is like an Aryan, like she's an Aryan dream. And then she got different colored hair and we started to see different shades. But the initial iteration of Barbie
right.
was Marilyn. Yeah. I mean, if you look at Gentleman.
Well, not as curvy. Well, actually, maybe curvy, but taller. Okay.
But also, yeah. She had to put on, you know, you had to put costumes on this thing and on this toy.
Sure.
I have always thought that, like, the, you know, I'm going to get slapped for this, but I've always thought that, like, the complaint of Barbie's physique was like, it's a doll. You got to put clothes on it. You need to be able to move around it and snap things and zip things and. You know, I don't know, but I'm not a parent, so I'll shut up on that. But
well, actually, that was the argument that her first dress designer made, because these very detailed early outfits, instead of the ones that are just sort of thoughts about clothing, actually mm-hmm. had, you know, several layers of band around the waist, because they were, you know, finely tailored clothes made with special thread that was, you know, an unusual size in order to make the miniatures work.
Right.
So I would say that is right on, George.
Thank you, MG. Gay people love glamour. Barbie's glamorous.
Yep.
Barbie's very glamorous, you know, and as a feminist myself, I think it's very interesting. You know, the Sex and the City characters often got the same complaint.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always wanted people to remember Barbie and the girls on Sex and the City, the women, pardon me, were like, you know, you had an attorney, you had a writer, you had a publicist, you had a gallerist. And then Barbie was not just a flight attendant. She was president. She was like, she was a surgeon. There's the Jane Goodall Barbie, you know, Barbie said to young girls, you could be all these things. Mm-hmm. Why not? That's a plus to me. But I'm sorry, I'm getting off the track of why she's so appealing to gay men.
But what about gay women too? I think so too.
She's a teaching tool for the performance of gender. I mean, in the late 80s and early 90s, gender
like
theory.
Judith Butler.
Exactly. Judith Butler was talking about the idea that gender is not necessarily an essential identity, but a performed identity, and that there is a difference between biological femaleness or biological maleness and femininity is an idea, a set of coded behaviors. I had the good fortune all those years ago to sit down for a few hours with the Lady Bunny and have her. Well,
I love her.
And Forever Barbie that needs to go back into print. She explained to me a lot of drag conventions, and we looked at the Barbie body, and it's essentially, it may be an Aryan dream, but it's also a man. It has shoulders that are dramatically wider than its hips, and the only thing that really signals female are these, you know, gigantic breast things, you know, that fully suggest Barbie is a drag queen.
And she is very corseted, like her torso shape is very corseted. It's really cinched.
It's also the shape of Dior's new look in the 1950s.
Ooh,
and
right.
Well, also, you know, that Barbie was, which made her kind of perfect for the early 60s. But by the late 60s, the cool kids were wearing those Carnaby Street clothes. Barbie had a Twiggy doll was one of her friends, and she got other friends. She got friends of color in the late 60s, and she also got friends with substantially less significant breasts who could wear those clothing, you know, for the Carnaby Street chic flat-chested clothes. One of her white friends was Francie, but she also had, and in a way, this isn't entirely tone deaf, just having friends of color in the late 1960s. Francie also came in a black iteration with the unfortunate name on her box of Colored Francie, but
Whoa.
Nevertheless,
oh God.
Well,
right.
Nevertheless, I mean, in the, you know, the whole idea in the late 1960s, Barbie both has always shaped and reflected the marketplace. And I think, you know, having friends of color was beginning to reflect, you know, the larger world. I mean, there was no draft card burning Ken or anything like that. And she kind of, you know, hid out in Malibu during the 1970s when she was not all that popular. But in the 80s, she was in harmony with the zeitgeist again. Big recession, lots of women going to work. Barbie was in her little suit with her little briefcase. The ad was the working mother comes home in the little suit, hands the briefcase to the daughter, and you hear the rousing anthem. And I admit, it actually is rousing of we girls can do anything, right, Barbie? I mean, I was singing along. My very jaded, 30-ish co-host was also moved by this. And we felt like there was something wrong with us, but it's very moving.
Do you think it was a good decision? I think it was a good decision, but how was the decision made to start using the name Barbie for a whole variety of women in that dolls who weren't just the stereotypical Barbie? Do you know why that decision was made and how it was made?
Well, I would say that it was made over time, again, reflecting and shaping the marketplace. The first black Barbie, although she had friends of color in the late 1960s, it wasn't until 1980 that the first black Barbie was made. And Mattel, probably aware that they would get a lot of scrutiny around making the actual dream girl, you know, black, made intelligent choices like hair texture that was slightly different from, you know, stereotypical Barbie's hair texture, features that were different from stereotypical Barbie's features. And she had a fabulous wardrobe designed by Kitty Black Perkins, an African-American designer at Mattel, who supervised, you know, very much the look of the doll. I think Jen, you're probably referring to how in 2016, Mattel decided to change the working formula. You know, that body, which had been untouchable, so to speak, for so many years, was finally tampered with, you know, a little micrometer of extra material around the thighs and hips and a little less material for the breasts. And I think that had to do with the whole kind of body positivity movement in, I guess you'd call it fourth wave feminism, you know, this sort of post-2012-ish feminism. And I mean, it's not like Mattel was out there on a limb by itself noticing this. All around in the popular culture, there was an acceptance of the idea that there was no perfect, there shouldn't be a perfect body. So you saw retailers like The Gap suddenly having models who didn't all look like they hadn't eaten mm-hmm. until, you know, since 1973 or right. It all changed.
Yeah. Like junky chic is no longer the style, thank God. So let's talk about the movie itself, starting with you, George. What was your experience? How did you dress up to go? What was your experience? And what were your biggest impressions about it?
My biggest impression from the Barbenheimer weekend was I did not know that Barbie built the atomic bomb.
Well, she did.
My first impression, I didn't dress up or anything. I went by myself, and I was very pleasantly, I don't want to say surprised, because I've always appreciated Greta Gerwig's sensibility. In fact, I was not surprised. I was just pleased, thrilled actually at some points. I thought it was funny. I thought it was touching at points, poignant. It's a satire. And I love what it says, and I think they had good fun with it. What surprised me was that Mattel was so game and seemed
for
to have
a takedown.
Yeah. And had a sense of humor about itself that I did not mm-hmm. expect at mm-hmm. all. They didn't seem to be as precious as I thought as I would have assumed they would be about right. their IP. And, yeah. I had a blast, and I've recommended it to everybody in my life.
Were people howling with
yes.
laughter in the theater?
Yes. And that's the other thing. I mean, for what it's worth, and you may get to this later, and I apologize if I'm jumping ahead, but
there's no jumping ahead or behind. This is all just a circular conversation.
But seeing a movie not streaming, I mean, it's great to have access at home to all of this yummy content that we've got access to, and we get to have the experience of watching something like Succession mm-hmm. or whatever shows and Just Like That or what everybody's into or whatever, but to actually share an experience was a refreshing experience.
Totally.
Period. To, you know, bump elbows with the person next to you or glance. Wasn't that funny? And not just any theater experience. The theater was packed.
Yep.
Like I had, you know, when I know we're not talking about Oppenheimer, but the same thing. It was a full house. And I went in the middle of the day, a weekday.
Didn't that feel good?
It felt great.
It felt post-COVID.
It felt great.
It felt like a celebration.
It felt great. And clearly the movie winks at us the entire time. And it wasn't people going, oh, awful, you know, having a Ben Shapiro reaction. People were on the same page and there to enjoy themselves, and they really did. And I loved it. I loved it. I could do it again.
The Ben Shapiro reaction is pretty hilarious.
Oh my God. His reaction is almost as long as the movie.
Yeah, it's so nutty. I mean, the idea of setting them on fire. I mean, it's just like, it's really bringing these whack job, misogynistic, incel, lunatic fringe out of the woodwork.
Yeah.
With matches going mm-hmm. after my dolls.
Yeah, we need to talk about his pyromania.
I mean, MG, George is talking about the experience and the laughter. Did you see that? And did you also, being a woman, have some sadness and tears? I mean, I felt like it was watching the movie Inside Out for me. I was like, it was very emotional for me too.
I went to a fan show before the thing actually opened. So uh-huh. it was full of, everybody was wearing pink and, you know, even the straight couples seemingly on dates. And that was actually, this was before the big weekend. And I felt like I didn't want the box office figures for the weekend. I wanted to know how many of those straight couples, if they actually talked about the themes in the movie, would remain coupled after that movie. It's such an indictment of patriarchy and so funny. I think my favorite line was probably, Ken with the horses. And finally, as he's disillusioned, he says, you know, when I realized patriarchy wasn't just about horses, I kind of lost interest. But yeah, America. America Ferrara made me cry. Her speech is fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, I've given that speech, and just hear someone else say it out loud was
that
remarkable.
That is the closest I've ever seen to anything in a movie theater getting a standing ovation was America Ferrara's monologue.
I did a little review of it for the USC website, which they illustrated with some clips from the movie. And then I was talking about how I had tears in my eyes with that speech. And of course, they put on a big full page thing of America Ferrara getting her little USC undergraduate degree. And I felt good about that. It linked in a way to my mother with all the graduation outfits for the dolls.
Oh.
You know, it added a layer of unexpected poignancy to the experience.
Nice.
To me, I think the moment that I was most emotional was when I realized, because I did not come in with any expectation. I didn't even know, if I had known Noah Baumbach, is that his name?
Baumbach.
If I known him been the co-writer, I might have been onto something, because I love Squid and the Whale and I love the Meyerowitz Chronicles. But anyway, when I got into the theater and I'm watching it, you know, I laugh at the very beginning about the baby dolls, but the moment for me that was so poignant was when she first gets into the real world and suddenly just gets this vibe. And to me, that vibe that it's, this world isn't made for me and I'm being judged, I was like, oh my God, that's like what it was like to awaken from childhood, realizing the world, being a little girl where I was so happy, just having fun, and then suddenly coming into womanhood and realizing this, that you can't do that, you can't behave that way. When you're a child, that you'd be tempting men if you do this, or you're an idiot unless you prove yourself, all this stuff. Like, I felt like I was reliving my growth from adolescence to adulthood as she stepped into the world. And then how funny it was when Ken's like, hey, I like this place. But I think, you know, MG, I think it's said a lot of good things about masculinity, because it's also a trap, right? I think a straight couple would end up more bonded after this movie talking about it, right?
Well, I guess if one went in the first place, you know, if you were, I don't know that much about how straight couples would react, but anyone who surreptitiously listens to Jordan Peterson or Ben Shapiro or whatever would probably not have been in that movie in the first place.
Well, they would have gone into Hate Watch it, you know, just so they could report back, you know, from the torture.
What is the hate about? Like, why did they?
Because it empowers women, Jen.
It's an
assault. It's an assault. And also, you know, the timing of this in the wake of, you know, the ending of Roe. Mm. I don't know when production started, so I can't really say. I don't know when the script was finished and greenlit, but the timing is very interesting. Against the backdrop of where we are now politically. And this is, as we've been saying, a film that empowers women. This is a film that celebrates women getting autonomy, making their own decisions. And look at how quickly, you know, it took years for Barbie Land to become Barbie Land, and how quickly it turned into, you know, Ken Land or whatever the hell that was. It took them no time. That's not an accident in the story as it's written. It took them, it took the Kens no time to destroy everything that was built. You know, they did it like that. And that,
your point,
that's going to piss guys off. And interestingly, piss off a lot of conservative women who, whether they want to acknowledge it or not, look like Barbie. But anything that gives women, the upper hand. Or anything that, you know, or anything that threatens the security of their, what they feel is their birthright. And look at, I've always made this, and then I'll shut up. I've always made this comparison with men when it comes to abortion. And I'm going to use a naughty word too. But when it comes to abortion, men who feel like they are entitled to weigh in, and have any say about what a woman says, does, wears, pursues, lives, whatever. It's like this. Women run pregnancy. It is the women's game. And a guy who comes in and chimes in and thinks he's got a say in that, when the contribution to reproduction from a man lasts 6 seconds, maybe seven if it's been a while. Like that's their contribution to the reproductive process. And if we're going to talk about abortion, it should be a 9-month conference and men get to talk at the very beginning for 7 seconds and then shut the fuck up and let the women run it because they do. So when it comes to like women running shit and having autonomy, it makes a lot of men really angry and uncomfortable. So I was not surprised at the reactions of the likes of Ben Shapiro and Matt Gaetz and anybody else. I mean, when women get access, when black people get access, when gay people get access, you know, it makes them real uncomfortable. And so it's not surprising to me.
I would also say a lot of men don't weather satire well.
No.
Also a lot of pompous women. And the ridicule of the necessity to have hierarchy in male world or ten world or whatever. Right. And the parody of violence, you know, if they can't attack one another with nuclear weapons, they're going to go after one another with tennis. I love the tennis rackets and the tube socks and it wasn't exactly Normandy D-Day on the beach, but it was definitely this, you know, you had the propensity for male violence.
But also there's another underlying layer, and I could be wrong, but I felt, not a fact, it's a feeling, an underlying layer of Ken, i.e. men, you're not as amazing as you think you are. Right?
Well,
you're not as amazing as you think you are. So pump the brakes, dial it down. What you're bringing to the table is not that incredibly fantastic. So just relax.
It's funny. I want to go back to, I'm not disagreeing with anything you're saying. In fact, I love what both of you just said, but I want to rewind to what you said a few moments ago, George, because it reminds me of the piece you sent me, the Jessica Bennett in the New York Times did that opinion piece where she went to the movies with Susan Faludi, author of Backlash and then Stiffed and some other things.
Susan and I went to the Barbie Museum together in 1993. Barbie Museum in Palo Alto. I think she was a fellow at Stanford at the time. We had a lot of fun.
Susan Faludi came to my house a couple years ago for a fundraiser. She lives right here in Northampton and teaches either at Smith or Amherst. I can't remember.
You guys travel in fancy circles.
But that piece was so good because she went to see it with this big, feminist. And Susan saw some of the abortion themes here. And, you know, we've talked a lot about the movie. There's some spoilers I just don't have to talk about. And for those of you who've seen it, you'll know what we're talking about. But I think there's definitely something about this movie. Its timing, the Supreme Court references, like they took over, and the way the movie ends to suggest that you can't be a real woman unless you have bodily autonomy. That's definitely the truth. And it's so funny that I didn't think this was as much of a... I hear what you're saying, George, about the, like, you know, men aren't all that, but...
I don't want to, let me be clear. It's, they're not as amazing as they think they are.
Oh, okay. I get it. I mean, the guitar scenes when they're playing the Matchbox 20. I mean, I was.
And explaining howling. The Godfather, that one I also really loved. I think, you know, they ridiculed men. And I think ridicule is probably the nuclear weapon in, you know, that war between the sexes.
Isn't there that thing that, what is that expression? Men are afraid of being laughed at and women are afraid of being murdered.
Yeah, like
understand that men, particularly and most specifically straight white men on this planet, are the only animals on this planet that have no natural predators. You know, as a gay man, I have predators. Mm-hmm. As women, you guys have predators. And
those
then you go down to the bottom.
Workers in the real world.
Oh, yes. That was brilliant. But straight white men are the only animals on the planet that have no natural predators. And they don't understand, you know, you, feeling threatened for your lives or your personal safety, you know. Every time I walk on the street behind a woman and she turns around, like, cause she, yep. you know, and I'm like, I'm not a threat. It's okay. But I understand that impulse. Yeah.
Actually, Susan Faludi also blurbed the original iteration of the Barbie book.
Oh, what did she say? Yeah, do you have it?
I probably have it somewhere.
When you find it, you can read it to us.
Yeah.
I think this other thing too about the way men can, any man can sit in judgment of any woman. Right. So that could be the most gorgeous, gorgeous, talented, smart, any kind of woman, whatever category you want. And any man can say, she's not all that. And that's such a funny thing that, and I think that's where this movie is also a breakthrough. I think part of what America Ferrera says is not just the whole speech about how there's no, that no woman is considered enough and why do we judge ourselves so harshly, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But it's the way she looks at Margot Robbie and says, you're perfect, and you, even you, mm-hmm. you know, and it's the way I think that has to do with women seen not just as objects, but as a prize. And the fact that if men are judging each other by, and again, I'm saying straight men, I'm speaking generally, by, you know, the kind of woman you have next to you is how you compete with other men. The hotter, not that you actually love the woman or that you find her attractive. It's just that if she seems to be, it's like the John Maynard Keynes winning the beauty contest. If she's the kind of woman that you think other men would want and you have collected her, then you have won with men. It has nothing to do with appreciating her. And I think that's a really terrible way. Like if a man would just like be around the women or the men they want to be around, they could stop this competition with other men.
Yes. And then the crisis with men, that's another conversation for another show. But I did love that moment when Barbie's sitting next to the old woman who's the costume designer, Anne Roth.
Yes.
And tells her that she's beautiful. And I love how yes. Anne takes the compliment and says something like, I know, right? Like she doesn't cower or offer some apologetic mm-hmm. thank you. She owns it and says, yeah, I am. And I love that positivity. Yes. I love that confidence because women are not allowed to be that confident. You have to apologize, right?
I think the whole idea of death entering the picture and time
yes.
entering the picture.
Yes.
I put up on my page a meme that someone had sent me years ago that I really loved. It was this, you know, it was Barbie's dream hearse. And it was, you know, white with the pink Barbie's dream hearse on
fabulous.
It. Yeah, but
fabulous.
I mean,
did you find the blurb?
Oh, actually, it's on the front of the, I think, the 2004 edition. Just
okay, well, look at you. Will you read it?
Well, it says, an elegant meditation on the meaning of Barbie will shake up your rusty preconceptions and make you think of America's most celebrated plastic dolls in ways you never have before. It's kind of
love
a marker
it.
Of the pivot from we categorically hate this thing to, you know, she may not be a feminist, but at least she's a touchstone for evaluating changes in feminism over time.
And she, so, and also along those lines on what we've been talking about, why was this so threatening? Barbie's in charge. Barbie's the boss. She's in charge. And the Supreme Court was all women. And it was just jarring to her when she saw the billboard. And it was Real Housewives. And she thought it was
the Supreme Court,
which is hilarious.
That's in my theater. The theater just like.
Brilliant. Yeah, I mean, there's just so many points. It's so well written. It's just, I think I love Greta and Noah. And I just want to go to their house for Thanksgiving. But
let's invite ourselves.
Please. I mean, that's
all
a list
us.
I want to get on. But
okay.
Barbie's in charge, a woman in charge, a woman is the boss, a woman running things. That is blasphemy
that's
to a
what
whole
makes
section
it
of our
so
culture.
So much fun.
And Barbie's always been in charge of her own life and calling her own shots and has, here it is, calling her own shots and life on her own terms.
Well, a few were a little less successful with that. I mean, some of the models of Barbie in the 1970s were, you know, one that was a kissing Barbie that mm-hmm. did nothing but crane up to a presumably taller Ken.
Right.
I mean, she couldn't have a more diminutive whatever.
Ugh.
You know, there were some very creepy iterations. Or the guardian goddess dolls, not literally Barbie, but in the Jack Ryan era. I argue that Barbie is a space age recasting of a Stone Age fertility totem, and these were wild.
Well, say that again. Say that again, because when I heard you say it before, I loved it, but I want you to say it another
Barbie
time.
Barbie was a space age, is a space age recasting of a Stone Age fertility goddess, a fertility totem. And Mattel was kind of onto this in the 1970s. And, you know, they had this wild product, the Guardian Goddesses, who, and the often in the 70s, because men were kind of in charge, the dolls were action toys. They did things. This thing was wild. I mean, you know, you almost have to see it to believe it. But trust me, because others have seen it. I have one, but I'm not going to scamper. In order to set her mechanism, you squeeze, and she's wearing like over the knee dominatrix boots and this, and this like Wonder Woman, you know, and she was accessorized with different breastplates and so forth, and a cape. And she's got a little dress over her breastplate. And to set her mechanism, her hands come together like this, and you squeeze her thighs together until they click. It gets better. And to release her mechanism, you spread her legs and she throws off her clothes. It was one of the wildest things. And in terms of the goddess thing, I mean, the head of sculpture at Mattel, when I was, you know, when I did my interviews in the early 90s, had been since 1970, he'd been there since 1972. He knew a thing or two about goddess archetypes and imagery. He was Italian. He'd been a sculpture restorer at the Uffizi, you know, and his discreet way of handling the goddess thing when I presented him with the fact that Barbie does look like a Venus figure with the pronged feet plunged into the earth to link to the great mother, or, well, there were just so many similarities. Anyway, so I'm running through this litany, and he says, and I say, well, you know, is she a goddess figure? And he discreetly says, I've heard that said.
Confession. Okay, before we wrap things up on our last round, I have one question that I must ask you, given my follow the money approach to things. Ruth Handler was pushed out of Mattel because of a little bit of financial irregularities. Also pleaded guilty to some white collar criminal type charges.
No contest or no low.
Well, yeah. I'm sorry. Pleaded no contest. Well, did she ever?
She argued.
Serve time?
She that this is a really remarkable story for your pink collar file, pink collar crime file, Jen. She did this amazing thing. She had to do, I think it was 57,000 hours of community service. I would have to look at the exact amount, but she had to do a lot of community service. So what she did, she got a building in Beverly Hills and she got her decorator to redo the inside of it. And she set up a job training program where white collar felons taught job skills to blue collar felons. I mean, it was the wildest thing. But in a way, kind of a good thing. And of course, after being thrown out of the company that she had started for not allegedly, I mean, she did plead nolo for lying to the SEC. She went on, because she was a brilliant marketer, to make a second fortune in the 70s designing and marketing mastectomy prostheses. As she said to me over an egg salad sandwich at the Hillcrest Country Club in 1993, honey, all my life I've gone from breast to breast.
Nice one. I like it.
That's perfect.
I like it.
Okay, friends, what did I not ask you that you wanted to say, and how do people find you? Starting with you, MG.
How do people find me?
Or what did I not ask you that you really wanted to say today, and how do people find you?
Let me think about what I wasn't asked. No, I think you covered a lot of useful bases. And people can find me on my website, mglord.com, which is being redesigned. And if my designer putting in the new Barbie stuff can't find me there, there's always the USC website, which was also, you know, I've got an email address there, and I have an email address on my website, which is under construction to make it more pink.
I love it. And you, George, what didn't we talk about that you wanted to?
Nothing. I loved this conversation. I mean, I could have talked about more. But no, this was great fun. And yeah. I can be found at my website at georgehahn.com. I'm also on Instagram at George Hahn. I'm on Threads at George Hahn. And I am on TikTok at George Hahn NYC.
And you can be found on a bicycle any day of the week.
Totally. Totally. Best way to get around. Save the planet. Ride a bike.
I like it.
Thank you.
Thanks, friends. Thanks so much, everyone, for listening. After we stopped recording, we just started talking in more detail about all the kids' toys we had and the different ones that we would like to play with. And I'm so sorry we didn't capture that all, but I'm sure you're feeling the same way. All of our memories flood back about childhood when we see a movie like Barbie. Right now, you might be hearing a thunderstorm in the background. I'm not sure if it's being caught on audio because we're also, in addition to it being Barbieheimer weekend, where Oppenheimer is, that film is also big, and we've got to think about things like nuclear war and other bummers like climate change. We've had a series of storms where I live that have been sort of, you know, record-breaking flooding, destroying crops, and flooding people out of homeless camps that are in our town. Very sad that there even are people living in tents, but on top of that, to have their tents flooded, all their possessions destroyed. Not trying to bring anybody down, but want to point out that part of the reason that it is so fun to escape into these fantasy worlds about dolls and childhood and what could have been is because there really are really hard things happening around us. I encourage everyone to see this film, though, who cares about choices in life, cares about freedom, cares about reproductive autonomy and gender identity. I think there's so much in it. And I also encourage people to do what George Hahn said, which is ride a bicycle or walk or carpool or do anything that you can on an individual level to cut back on carbon emissions. That said, as I read this piece Abigail Disney wrote recently, in case you are someone who flies in a private jet, stop doing that. Jesus, fuck, why are you doing that? People who fly in private jets, and if you're listening, I'm talking to you, are responsible for so much more carbon emissions, while the rest of us are feeling guilty about not recycling or not carpooling, or I'm haranguing you to ride a bike instead of get in the car, all things that are good. Really, if everybody stopped riding in their stupid private jets, and also if, you know, the whole cryptocurrency industry could just stop, that would be nice too, because it's also killing the planet with all the server farms. I'm on a roll right now. But, you know, as George said, you know, Barbie's in charge, and I guess I'm in charge of this podcast, but really you guys are in charge, and I want you to give feedback to me. And you know how to do that. Let us know what you think. Send an email to bookedup@politicon.com. And you can also write to us at P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01061. I'll be back next week, as always, with another show as we continue to explore the writing process and the nonfiction world together. And to keep up with us and our featured authors, follow Booked Up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And please give us a 5-star review. It really will help other people find the podcast.